Also, he has a really weird saying in there, which I totally disagreed with, but I thought it was funny that he thought it was important to talk about, which was he said, like, which is a saying, and I think it was the Navy or something, where they said, slow is efficient, efficient is fast. Slow is fast.
Scotch.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 126 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I'm doing all kinds of weird web things.
I'm Sam, and I'm waving my head around.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, working in the games industry. Today is November 20 Cyber 2000 Cyberteen. Because it's Cyber Monday today.
Cyber Mon week.
Before we get started, we have a warning. Anything can happen on this show. There will be profanity. So if you're a child, get out of here. All right. First thing, news. We had Tajibi.
Yep.
Which is Thanksgiving break. That's Tajibi.
For some reason, I feel like if you find a good punchy acronym to convert a period of time into, it just makes it better.
Yeah.
You know? So we went with TGB, which just feels amazing to scream for some reason.
Or Tajibi, if you want to really like roll the emphasis around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I think, first of all, why did we do this? Because what happens in a typical workplace environment is everybody says, my family's coming for Thanksgiving. And then the workplace says, that sucks.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's sort of the end of that exchange.
usually, most places get either Wednesday off before or just the day of.
And then they'll have to go back on Friday.
Some places. Yeah. It's crazy. So we were looking at it and we said, you know what, if we actually, because we're going to give off Wednesday and Thursday, you know, like it's typical stuff because people want to be able to prepare for.
And we already don't have Friday.
Families, we already don't do Fridays. And so, but then we were looking at it, we said, you know, if we also do Monday and Tuesday, then everybody gets a 10-day break.
Yeah.
At the cost of only 2 days of studio time. So what if we just did that.
Give people the time they need to take vacations or go places or be with family.
And, you know, it seemed like the right time to do it because we've been doing it we've been sort of pedaling to the metal over here and everyone had a great break. It seemed like it was a perfect amount of time. There's just a lot. Everyone did a lot of stuff, but also didn't lose their marbles, you know, which is nice.
I feel like one more day, there just marbles would have been
a mess.
Would have been everywhere.
A pile on the floor. But before TGB, we all put together sprint posts. So essentially saying, like we normally do during the week, here's what I'm going to try to do over this 10-day TGB, which for some reason, again, naming it makes it feel like it's a thing, like it's a particular chunk of time. It's like a New Year's resolution sort of thing. So
TGB.
I made a list of like 15 items I was going to try to do. And of course, I didn't get all of them done. But the whole point being, because I made the list, I got a lot of things done as opposed to
because you had a list to go look at instead of every day waking up and being like, what should I do today?
Yeah. So it was great. We worked on talks, I did some marketing work, and then also just played a heinous amount of video games.
Yeah.
It was great.
Heinous.
Heinous.
You better be careful. You're going to you're going to go to jail for that.
Yep.
I worked on doing some calculus work through Khan Academy as a nice refresher. I took calculus way back in the day. I need it. I need to know it now, and I don't know it. Yep. I don't remember it. Don't know how it works. Mm-hmm. Don't even know why it is, what it is, or how it do.
It has something to do with an apple hitting a man. That's all I've
picked up. A man killed an apple creature.
With his head.
With his face. Yep. Then something happened. I believe he
siphoned the knowledge out of it with his fangs.
He created some kind of prism and killed the animal with lasers, I think. I'm not quite up on the history of calculus.
There's a whole mythos, you know.
There's a whole thing around it. So I need to sort of relearn that whole lore.
Well, there was also a battle to the death between the two co-inventors of calculus because...
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. It was actually history's first laser battle.
That's true.
So, yeah.
Prisms, lasers,
just all that.
Spectacular.
All that stuff.
Adam had an interesting view about the break, which is referring to it actually as a sabbatical.
Yeah.
Instead of a break. Because we've talked about how when you take a weekend, you get weakened from the weekend.
Yes.
Right?
So the idea is. When you take a break, you get broken.
You break.
So you do. But if you take a sabbatical, you get sabbatted.
Yeah. Yep.
Yep. So we wanted to get sabbatted. Not broken, nor weakened. So all of a sudden, these list of things. But Adam, how was it for you overall?
It was spectacular. I spent a solid 30 hours, I think, over the week, just doing Udemy courses on front-end web development.
Just shoving that knowledge in.
Yeah, which has been my nemesis since the very beginning, mostly because it's all, you know, a lot of it's there's a lot of tech there, but there's also a lot of design focus. Mm-hmm. And since I've been shoring up all of my back-end knowledge and doing all the stuff I've been doing over the past year, but I still can only make really ugly stuff. And at some point that just becomes like, that's a serious hole that needs to get plugged.
Right. Yeah.
But all of my knowledge of front end web development is, you know, based on stuff I just barely learned a long time ago. And so I know some jQuery, know some HTML and CSS, and I just kind of hack together simple websites. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to actually learn, you know, the fancy front end frameworks that do all kinds of stuff for you that are really cool and magical. And so I just needed a solid window of time to do nothing but think about that. And so that's what I used my break for.
Beautiful.
It was spectacular.
Hell yeah, man.
Also, we ate a ridiculous amount of food.
We did.
Puppy chow, which for you non-Midwestern folk, I think the
Is Chex, that a Midwestern thing?
It's largely Midwestern.
I think Chex now has like a recipe on the box.
They call them Muddy Buddies.
Muddy Buddies.
What? Yeah, because you can buy them.
So there's, Muddy Buddies.
Yeah, there's Chex Mix, like the bags of Chex Mix, right? But they also have a Muddy Buddies bag.
It doesn't taste as good as
homemade. It's not as good because it's presumably mostly
Chex Mix
corn
syrup
or something. Yeah.
Yeah. So Chex Mix is what? It's chocolate, peanut butter.
Butter.
Chex.
Also butter.
Butter. You kind of turn that into a glob,
mm-hmm.
and then you just like throw them in powdered sugar in a bag and you shake the shit out of it.
Yep. And then you end up with this. So it's a Chex hex. I think they're hexagon. So it's a Chex hex.
That's the hex part of the Chex.
It's a C hex.
Yeah. It's a corn hex.
So corn hex.
It's a Chex.
Wait.
Maybe that's what it is. So you take that and then basically what happens though is that they get magically converted because they're covered in delicious stuff. And then my favorite part about it is you have this huge bowl afterward of if you make it in the quantities that we do in the Midwest, which is only like 10 gallons at a time.
Yep.
That's the only way to make puppy chow.
Yeah.
Or Muddy Buddies. And then the best part is if you pan it. So if you shake the pan of all the stuff, then like the huge ones that basically somehow massed, it's a huge sort of abomination of all these Chexes glom together, shake to the top.
Yeah, you can take pan for fatties, size. For big fat Chex pieces.
You take this softball-sized glob of chocolate, corn hexes, and powdered sugar, basically.
Then man. You just bite into that thing like a big big sugar apple.
Then you take a nap.
Take a nap because you're going to have diabetes. And you got to sleep that off.
Take a nap.
So that was our Tajibi.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good. We also have a Cyber Mon Week sale.
Yep.
Because it's not a Cyber Monday sale. It lasts for the whole week.
You know, we know.
It's kind of like the Black Friday sale, which is actually the Black Friday week.
It really is now. It really is.
So we have our Cyber Mon Week sale over at shop.bscotch.net, mm-hmm. where we got all of our merch. We also are on sale on iOS. Crashlands is 58% off. It's a very specific amount. So that's going pretty good. And so, yeah, if you want to get in on those.
Will that still be true when the podcast goes up?
Yes. Yeah. It's going through this, like the second or mm-hmm. something like that. Okay. So you got plenty of time.
Yeah. But we're gearing up for the holiday season. So if you want to get merch, if you want it shipped in time for Christmas, which you probably do, or I guess just the end of the month, if that's your thing, then I think you need to place your order by the 18th. So dilly dally.
And the sooner the better because we're not, as we've said, we're not Amazon.
Yeah,
we're just going to get your package when you get it.
There is a single person named Monique who will package all your things.
Yeah.
So she's actually going to bike it to you.
Yeah.
And that just takes some time.
It takes minutes.
Yeah.
And we here's the thing. We want to get you merch, but you have to want to get it more because we're taking, as soon as the 19th comes, we're taking a breather here.
That right? vacation that we just had was so good.
We're so tired from Thanksgiving break that we got to take a sort of winter break. So that's, you know, get your orders in, especially right now during Cyber Mon Week.
Get some bundles you can save money on, I think.
Yeah. Otherwise, Sam and I spent a good portion of the break planning our talks for the Uruguay trip. We're going over to the Level UI conference.
Level Up UI, I think. Level Up Uruguay.
Level Up Uruguay
conference.
I don't know where the Y is.
The UI. UY is Uruguay's.
Uruguay's country
abbreviation,
I guess.
Yeah.
All right.
Sure.
So, so we're doing that. We're giving a talk on marketing, which has come out to be pretty interesting. So we were discussing with the organizers of the conference, sort of like because we just said, you know, we'll talk about whatever. So just tell us what you need.
What do people care about?
What do people care about over there? And they basically said that, that a lot of smaller developers have a lot of sort of confidence issues when it comes to self-publishing. Mm-hmm. And it's something that people tend to not really do a lot of. Right. So we've done a lot of research for this talk about why self-publish and how to self-publish, because that's what we do. You know, we don't use a publisher. So that's coming together pretty good. And we've came up with some pretty alarming statistics, facts and figures about sort of the trends in the games industry, which are, you know, we know where it's going, which is that it's just ludicrously saturated. Mm-hmm. But the extent to which that is becoming the case is just more and more sort of, it's reached a point beyond sort of being alarming and more into sort of like the
absurd.
Yeah. So I think it was looking at the Steam Spy data. So every July they put out an update on over the previous year, how many, like what's the median number of owners for any given game on mm-hmm. Steam based on launch month. And by the time you get into, so in 2011, the median owners per game on Steam was 220 something thousand. Now it's 4,000.
Yep.
So, you know, there's
success is not guaranteed.
But again, this is simply because so many games are coming out, most of which don't do anything. And of course, so the average sales on Steam are something closer to 50,000, but the median is 4,000, which basically tells you that most games do nothing, and then a handful of games do really, really, really well.
Yep.
Which has kind of always been the case, but there's just more room. There's more room at the bottom now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's always been the case, except that the games that didn't do well weren't even in the market.
Right. They just never ended up on Steam.
Right. So really, the market is exactly the same as it always has been.
It's just a lot
except
more bad
all
stuff.
The stuff that also doesn't sell anything is now visible in that market to some extent.
Yeah. So
because this is what I saw last year when I did that analysis to look at.
Well, we actually reread it to put together some of this talk.
Yeah. And that was what I saw that time is that if you look at the top of the graph over time,
it's basically
those games
same.
That are up there that are performing really well. There's kind of the same, just the same number of stuff selling the same number of copies up there.
Yeah. So if you're like, what are the sales figures for the top, you know, 10 or top 20 games on Steam?
Right.
And it's just
it
the
just
same.
Comes out the same.
Comes out the same every time.
Yep. There's just more and more stuff kind of filling out those lower layers.
Right. Yeah.
Actually, I think you should revisit that article because there's some pieces you said where you're like, I can't tell this until I need to do another analysis.
Yep.
You should read through it. It's pretty interesting.
Fun. Yeah.
Yeah. So we've been working on that and we're leaving next week. Mm-hmm. It's 18 hours of flying, I think.
I got books. I think I only have enough books to get there because it's an 18-hour trip. I'm going to easily read like 3 books.
Yeah, the thing I need to figure out mostly is what to do about my ass. Because
is that what we all need to figure out?
Every time I've flown to India,
is your ass going to sleep?
Well, no, by the time I get like 5 hours in, my tailbone just fucking hurts from sitting just on these like really uncomfortable
airplanes. You should get a neck pillow.
And then use it,
it as a butt pillow.
Yeah, because what you need is really, you need kind of like a bicycle seat where like it pads your butt cheeks, but then it leaves room for your tailbone. You know, I think it's kind of stupid that we have a tailbone to begin with, but
we don't have tails anymore. So probably
we just have a bone for where it used to be.
Yeah, just use a neck pillow and then flip it, you know, so it's like a toilet seat basically, but inverted.
Mm.
So the hole's in the back where your tailbone is.
There you go. I'm going to do that.
That solves all your problems.
Or you get 2 sort of skinny pillows, but one under each leg.
Yeah.
You know, kind of elevate yourself.
Yeah.
So that's sort of my number one concern right now is
blood clots.
So I'm going to see, ass preservation, blood clots. You got to stand up and stretch.
Also, it's a United flight, so we might
die. You might get assaulted.
That does actually help with the blood clots, though. Like when they kind of beat the shit out of
really
you,
gets it really
it loosens up the blood, you know, kind of gets like
blunt force trauma.
When you go to the hospital, they put those leg massagers on there. And on a United flight, the attendants just come by and punch you in the leg sort of every now and then.
So, and you also have to go through U.S. Customs on the way back, which is...
Then you get punched there as well.
It's a nightmare hellscape.
Yep, they will. I remember one time I flew for 30 hours coming from India. I landed in Chicago, and I got to Chicago, and you have to go through customs, and you go back through security. When I went back through security, they swiped my hands with one of those stupid chemical pads, and they're like, there's gunpowder on your hands. I'm like, you guys... I've already been flying for 30 hours. Like, if I was going to do something, you missed the moment like a long time ago here.
But also, where would it have come from?
Yeah.
You know?
which kind
of, I didn't have it on me before.
I land in Chicago. Now I have gunpowder on me. Like, maybe.
I mean, there is a lot of gunfire in Chicago. So maybe
it's just kind of in the United States. It's just kind of a gunpowder sort of cloud. Yeah. It's just kind
sure
of
seemed like it. Yeah.
All right. So then one final thing to talk about in the news before we get on to questions is loot boxes.
So you know what? We told you guys this was coming.
We called this shit
Gray Rhino.
Over the summer, we talked about Rocket League and their loot boxes and how we were kind of bummed about it.
Mm-hmm. Overwatch, I think. Talk about that one.
Overwatch, and then probably 4 or 5 episodes ago, maybe more than that, we talked about the concept of a Gray Rhino, which is an oncoming event that everybody should see coming, but nobody seems to do anything about it or get out of the way. Mm-hmm. And we talked about potential gray rhinos in the games industry, and loot boxes was kind of the thing at the top of our mind as something that is probably going to cause some problems that people don't really, for some reason, want to foresee, probably because there's a lot of money involved. Mm-hmm. So just over the past, like, week, 2 weeks, the conversation about loot boxes has taken a hilarious turn. Mm-hmm. It's first starting with Star Wars Battlefront 2, which is published by Electronic Arts. So what happened with Star Wars Battlefront 2 is it's a $60 premium game, and EA just crammed it full of loot boxes for things that were required to progress through the game and to unlock new capabilities. So like all the different heroes that you were going to play as and equipment and stuff like that, you could either grind for hours and hours and hours.
Well, I think it's not even just hours and hours. Wasn't it 4,000 hours?
Somebody did the math and it came out to like, you'd have to work full time 40 hours a week for a year and a half to unlock all the stuff in the game.
Beautiful.
Or you could spend $2,100 on loot boxes.
Mm-hmm. Actually, do they sell loot boxes or do they sell? Because this might be a separate problem.
No, they sold loot boxes.
It was loot boxes.
The stuff that you got, you couldn't ever get the thing you wanted. It was through these loot boxes. And for those who are unfamiliar, loot boxes it's like a little, like a chest or a crate or something.
The best way to think about it is the physical version of
A slot machine.
It's a slot machine, but the physical version is also like getting card packs, right? If you go to get a Pokemon card pack, you don't know what's in it. You don't buy a particular card. You buy this pack, and there's this experience of unwrapping it and getting stuff. The difference with the loot box, of course, is it's a digital good. And in the case of these, like the progression of a game that already is a $60 game being bound to this loot box system gets kind of weird.
Yeah, it violates people's expectations because they assume that if they've paid for the game, now they have the game, and now they can achieve things in the game and progress through the game through playing it, right? Because that's reasonable. And so Electronic Arts came into Reddit to try to, like one of their community relations team members came into Reddit to try to tamp down this problem, and they simply made sort of a very sort of cut and paste PR statement about how everything in the game is optimized to sort of maximize the amount of pride and sense of accomplishment that players feel, and which of course was a total cop out because that is absolutely not what a paid random loot box does. You don't feel proud for getting a random, you know, Darth Vader unlock or something for paying $5. And so that comment quickly became literally the most downvoted comment in the history of Reddit. Last I checked, it was over 700,000 downvotes.
That's pretty impressive.
So this turned into a huge PR nightmare for EA.
Got big enough that it actually hit the mainstream media. And this is where the problem actually finally begins for EA.
So Star Wars is owned by Disney. And it's not owned by EA. Mm-hmm. And Disney has a philosophy. I think there was a gamesindustry.biz article. Definitely worth reading about how Disney approaches their intellectual property. And basically Disney's stance is the preservation of the value of the IP is absolutely paramount. And anything that will damage people's perception of the IP needs to be dealt with immediately.
Even at short-term cost.
Even if it's profitable. Mm-hmm. And so the CEO of Disney called the CEO of EA and had some words, and then and now EA is changing that entire model. They're turning off the microtransactions. However, their announcement was that they will be turning those microtransactions back on at a later date once they have rebalanced things. Mm-hmm. So this is not the end of it, but there was just this just overwhelming sort of tsunami of community backlash that just crushed EA under this. So that happened. And then just over the weekend, I think on Friday, some news came out about Destiny 2. Ooh.
So they're called Bright Engrams, but it's loot. It's not great.
So the way progression works in Destiny 2 is you level up. It's a shooter MMO kind of a thing. You level up to the max level, which is level 20. And then from there, your experience bar stays, but now experience doesn't give you levels. It gives you loot boxes. Mm-hmm. So you get the XP bar to the end. You get a Bright Engram, which is a loot box. So it's basically you just pull a slot machine, lever, and you get some new thing for your character. Again,
if it's just in the context of the game, it's fine.
It's fine. But of course,
the problem is you can buy them.
Of course, they sell Bright Engrams. I believe they are cosmetic items. So this does sort of, it takes a less sinister tone, unlike the...
I think there's weapons in there.
There might be, but I'm pretty sure that it's cosmetic. But so that's not bad in and of itself. The kicker is that Activision was suppressing the truth about how much experience people were getting, where the longer somebody spent trying to get experience points to unlock these things, the more they would suppress how much experience they got. And so essentially what they were doing is they were singling out the players who wanted these things the most and making it harder for them to get them through normal gameplay,
invisibly.
Yep. But invisibly. So they would actually...
Well, in fact, it wasn't even invisibly. I think
they lied.
It was supposed...
So the game would say, you just got 5,000 experience for defeating that thing. But really, it would give you like 100 or something.
It would just take longer and longer to do everything. Yeah. Right.
So the more energy you put into unlocking these things, the more the game would suppress your progress while telling you that your progress was not being suppressed. So this, of course, exploded. as one might expect, because the intention there is, again, it's just like EA's sort of cop-out response of, well, this is to give players a sense of pride and accomplishment, this is just another thing to quietly single out the players who really want a thing and try to find ways to
get them to pay for it,
extract cash from them.
Yep.
So this happened. There was a big sort of PR post by Activision by Bungie actually going in and saying, yep, we've reviewed the data and we see that, this system isn't doing what we had hoped it would do. And so we're going to update this system. Anyways, all this is to say this shit is getting out of control and it's now reached a point where, so it's kind of the lines between sort of like online slot machine and video game are getting blurred so much so. So I know the state of Hawaii had a big referendum.
Yeah. Well, basically was it a senator or who was it?
It was a state rep in Hawaii.
Yeah. Basically came out and said, this is insane. He goes, this is a Star Wars themed casino. That's what he called
it. Yeah. And he said, we came together against the tobacco industry to say, you're not going to use Joe Camel to convince our kids to smoke. And we should also not allow companies to use Star Wars to convince our kids to gamble.
Yeah.
It's just like, ooh, damn.
That's hidden somewhere. And then across the pond in Belgium, they're doing an investigation about the whole thing and apparently planning to take something to the EU about potential regulations for this stuff. The UK gambling body, I believe, found it to be not technically gambling because it doesn't do one of the things that is required by their laws before they can intervene, which is essentially being able to pull the converted currency back out into real world money. But they did basically said like, this is really blurring the lines here. Get real weird.
Yeah. Cause it is the case that it is definitely in violation of the terms of use for these games, but it is something that players do, which is to resell their accounts for those games to other players. So you can, spend money on these loot boxes, get items for your character and then sell that account to somebody else. So, I mean, it isn't the case that these things don't have a real world.
Yeah, but
monetary value.
But if it's against the terms of use, that's not, and there's not a mechanism provided for that. Right. I don't think there's any argument there at all that that's what's happening.
But yeah, so again, this is coming. This is coming. It's arrived in some forms already. So I'm really curious to see kind of what happens to the regulatory landscape over this, and when someone's just going to say, like, that state rep did, that, yeah, this is just straight up gambling. You guys are just, it's all you're doing.
Well, I think just like how the term, you know, microtransaction sort of became a dirty word for quite a while, now loot box is breaching that same point where as soon as somebody says that a game has loot boxes in it, right, you know, how many people is that going to turn off from playing that game? And so that's actually something that has kept me from wanting from buying Overwatch. It's something that's kind of pushed me away from Rocket League, mm-hmm, where before they had loot boxes, I was really into the game. And then all of a sudden I keep getting these like boxes that I need to now spend dollars to buy keys to open and get random rewards, mm-hmm, you know?
And you're like, can I just buy what I want?
Yeah. And I'm like, I don't like the game just dangling. Yeah. Cause like their original model was they would
show you things and you buy it.
They'd show you things. You'd be like, I want that thing. And you spend a dollar on it. You know, I was totally happy to do that, mm-hmm, but now I don't get to make that decision. Now I have to gamble. Like the game, if I want to get a new thing, I have to gamble, right, which I don't like. So, I mean, I know personally this has pushed me away from either purchasing games or playing games that I already owned. And I have to wonder how much that's, you know, doing the same for a lot, mm-hmm, of other people.
Well, so, but the problem here is that it's such an effective way to pull money out of, correct, people.
Specific people.
Yeah, yeah. But enough of them and enough money.
Yeah.
And the games themselves are now completely designed around doing that.
Oh, it's good. It's
so coming. That it doesn't actually matter if your population of players decreases, even if you halved your population of players as a consequence.
If you're making 10 times more money from the rest.
Yeah, on average, right? Yeah. Then you're still going to do just financially way, way better. And unfortunately, that's where all the incentives are. Yeah. So I think we're stuck with this until regulation
comes
it.
In. Yeah.
Yep. God dang. So this gray rhino is continuing to barrel toward the games industry.
Mm-hmm. Soon.
And everybody's going to try to make as much money as they can and not bother.
It's giving all of us it's kind of like back in the 90s when everyone was all up in arms about violence in video games.
Mm-hmm.
And it gave all the video games a bad name.
Yeah.
For a long time, actually.
So now video games are gambling.
Thanks, EA.
Now they're violent gambling.
Yeah. Which, of course, people are less concerned about because there's a lot of money involved.
And as long as there's not a nipple.
Yeah.
You know, as long as no.
Yeah.
The violence is fine.
Violence and gambling, perfect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Keep those nipples out of there. So that's happening. We'll see what happens.
Gray Rhino Watch. That's what we'll be doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So then there's a question of is there something that you can do as a savvy person to sort of take advantage of these companies not getting out of the way? So you could try to short
EA stock.
Which I would not recommend doing.
Literally never short a stock.
You should never short a stock because if you short a stock,
that's the best way to go bankrupt.
Yeah, your best case scenario is that you double your money and your worst case scenario is that you owe infinite money. Because there's no limit to how high a stock can go, but there is a limit to how low it can go. Anyways, a little investor tip for you. All right.
Yeah, don't.
Don't short things.
Yep.
All right. Unless you have insider trading information, in which case that's illegal and you're going to jail.
All right. well, you're not going to go to jail.
No, you'll be real.
You'll be
fine.
As long as you do it big enough, you definitely won't go to jail. Martha Stewart, though.
No,
she went to jail. It does happen.
Of all people.
Anyways, all right, let's get out of some questions. These questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. So if you'd like to get your questions on a future episode, head on over there and ask away. First question comes from Retro Banana Man NL. NaNoWriMo is over. How did it go for you? I tried, but life happened. Thesis stuff. So I only reached 5K words. Sad face.
How'd it go for you guys? I didn't do it. So
I got caught up up to the halfway point, which was then a few days of intense work and then Thanksgiving break started.
Yeah.
So for Thanksgiving break, I had two choices. So one was finish my NaNoWriMo project and the other one was
learn stuff.
And so I decided for that break that I wanted to, because I wanted to be able to apply front end web dev stuff to my work the moment I got back. And so I needed that week to just be able to dive into a thing and learn it. Otherwise I literally wouldn't be able to do the job that I needed to do for who knows how long.
Slightly more
months,
important.
Right? So I decided that was more important at the time. And then that's what it is. So I basically wrote 25,000 words for my NaNoWriMo. Then Thanksgiving break started. And I did. I made a choice and did 30 hours of Udemy courses instead. And I still am going to finish my NaNoWriMo project, though.
It's a programming book, isn't it?
It's a book about computer stuff.
How computers work.
Yeah.
For the layperson.
Yeah. But for the smart layperson who just actually wants to know. Not the computers for dummies style where it's just right. Like, give me the bare minimum I can scrape by with, you know. So
whenever I think of a layperson, I think of a person laying on the ground being like, I don't get it.
It's yeah.
hard.
Yeah. It's not far from the truth, I don't think.
Well, how'd yours go, Seth? What's your situation?
I got up to 31,000 words, and then I reached a similar crossroads, I think, where...
Oh, so your technique was completely different, because you would just...
I just did it in, 8,000-word bursts. yeah, so I think there were a couple questions I wanted to answer with National Writing Month, which is this hard? And also, do I enjoy this? And the answer was basically no in both. I enjoyed kind of the early stages of writing, but because I don't actually have aims to publish a book, I don't have aims to be a novelist. I learned a lot from it, but I think the act of just like being in the chair typing for 8 hours at a stretch was... I don't know. I have other things that I could be doing that I actually do move my life forward in meaningful and big ways that are more aligned with my goals. And so I decided after 31,000 words, I was like, okay, I've demonstrated that I'm capable of doing this, of writing just tens of thousands of words. Mm-hmm. And so I just was like, all right, I'm good. I did it.
Yeah. I think it's mostly you have to do it for a reason.
Yeah.
Right. And so once
the reason is passed.
Yeah. Once the reason is passed. And for me, it was that the reason I was doing it is because I hadn't in a long time and I hadn't actually just sat down and written for a long time. So I wanted to make sure I
could do it.
Did that and kind of brushed up on the skills a bit. And I've also wanted to put a book like this together that I started writing. And I just hadn't had something that was sort of like an impetus to do it. Cause there was always, there just always is stuff I'd rather be spending my time doing, usually learning new stuff that could go into the book, right? But just learning stuff. And so NaNoWriMo is a nice thing because it's this large community doing it. It sort of serves as the impetus by itself because it's just an event, you know? And so for me, it was just, I wanted to use that as the sort of driving thing to force myself to get started on the thing, even though there was stuff that I'd rather be doing instead. So I use it as a mechanism to switch my priorities temporarily.
Yeah.
But it definitely was the case that as soon as I truly had time, and like lots of it to do something, then it didn't seem like a good use of it.
Yeah,
because that's only for me. That's because of where my priorities are right now, which are not.
Some people get really hung up about quitting stuff, you know?
Yeah.
You just got to know what your values are.
Well, I think the thing that makes quitting things hard or like feel weird is if you didn't actually know ahead of time what you were trying to do. Because if you haven't managed to do that yet, then you should probably keep going. But if it's the case that you did...
Answer the questions you wanted to answer or accomplish the things you want to accomplish. Because to me, I mean, 50,000 words it's arbitrary.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't. And actually, if you read the book, No Plot, No Problem, which is by the creator of National Novel Writing Month, he's like, 50,000 words. We all just thought it seemed like a pretty good number. There's actually no rationale behind it.
It's a good number.
Seems like
a lot.
Yeah. So for me, I had always had ideas about what it would be like to write, and to be a writer. This gave me an opportunity to do that experiment and kind of see what it was like. And it turns out I get a lot more joy out of programming and reading.
Cool.
So, So that was it. All right, next question comes from
my wife. Crushed it though. I just wanted to say,
yeah, that's so true.
She was finished last week.
Dang.
She's still going. Cause she's writing a novel for realsies though. So,
yeah.
So that was basically NaNoWriMo was just like what she was already doing. Now she just counted the words for NaNoWriMo during that time, you know?
Right. So. Yeah, she moved pretty fast, I have to say.
That's awesome.
Yeah. All right, so next question comes from Sly Fox Glove. Seth, how did you decide you wanted to program the games instead of any of the other fields? Right now, I'm going to start a one-man operation. Any beginner tips?
Mm.
So I guess maybe the question is, like instead of the other fields, meaning instead of doing art or some other aspect.
Everything else related.
Yeah. So I also started as a one person operation. So I didn't decide I wanted to program the games. I just decided I wanted to make games. And programming was one of the things that I had to do. So it just turned out that after doing that for about a year and a half, then when Sam and I started working on Butterscotch stuff, then I had moved pretty far ahead on the programming side. to the point where I could just do most things pretty well. And so I just kind of defaulted into that role. Mm-hmm. So at no point did I decide I wanted to be a games programmer. I just wanted to make games, and that just happened to be something that I could do.
Yeah, well, all of us basically had the same thing happen, where it was more a question of what is necessary currently.
I will do what is needed.
Mm-hmm. So Adam now does web programming, but when he came on,
not because we were of like, a burning passion for the internet.
Yeah, yeah. When he came on, we were like, we don't know what to do with you. And so he hung out for a month or so, worked on some little projects and things. He worked on shaders
for
a few weeks.
Well, because my background was in image analysis. So I was like, shaders, that's just image stuff. So
turns out we don't need very many of them. Nope. So, you know, that dried up.
But
after
we got
2 weeks.
Two
we got
or three
some water. We got some hologram shaders. Mm-hmm. And then
we were like, wait, these don't work on mobile. What are we even doing?
Yep. Yeah. And then Adam was like, I guess I could bang out web stuff. Mm-hmm. Basically
so he
the conversation
just went into a cave with a box of scraps and made B-Scotch ID.
Yep.
Tony Stark style.
Yeah. I mean, basically all of it's the same, which is, yep. Hey, we need a thing and there's only one of us or two of us or three of us. So
yeah, I think coincidentally, I was the only one who came into it with some pre-existing skill that applied directly to the thing that I was doing. Correct. So that just became the natural thing that I did. And then, yeah, Adam and Sam just learned stuff.
Had no skills.
From the ground up. So, yeah. So beginner tips, just make everything. Just do everything you can.
Yeah.
It's also the case that if you start as a one-person operation, if you are able to actually do things that are good because you practice a shitload, then it becomes very easy to become a two-person operation because you inspire confidence in other people at your capacity to execute.
Yes.
So if you just decide, I want to make a video game, and you just, you know, call your best friend or something, and you have no skill and no capacity to actually do any of the things that you want to do.
And then you say, I'm going to be the programmer.
Yeah.
You can be the other thing.
That's a pretty tough sell. Yeah. So.
Because at least one person on your team needs to be able to do something.
At least one person should be able to do something.
That's how we got started.
Yeah. That's all you need.
Yep.
So you're good. All right. Next question comes from Degeki. What systems do you use to help prioritize your work day and your life? What do those systems look like?
I like the old idea of eating the frog, which is you decide what the most important thing is that you could get done that day.
And then you eat a frog.
Do it in the morning.
And you eat a frog.
Well, the idea is that usually that's like a heavy thing. It's not going to be like, oh yeah, make this call or talk to this
person. I'm having trouble seeing the metaphorical connection.
You know,
the frog.
I don't know.
I think it's probably because you don't want to eat a frog.
Yeah, but you need to eat the
but
frog.
But for some reason,
but frog
you need
legs
to,
are delicious.
But you don't
are.
Need to
but
eat
the rest
the whole
of the frog.
Frog
is disgusting.
That's fair.
You get that tongue? No, it's disgusting. But yeah, I think I'm not sure why people were eating frogs. It's an old adage. So who knows what the circumstances
old
were.
Old timey people said a lot of weird shit.
They did say a lot of weird
it
stuff.
It might have just gotten lost in translation too, you know, over the years. Sort might of this have. Game of telephone problem. Yep.
Yeah. So, but anyways, eating the frog is the idea of when you're making a list for the day, if you just say, okay, what would be, I usually do. Ask myself the question, what would be if I did these three things? What three things if I did today would make it so that this day and then like the setup for tomorrow was really good? And I find that framing to be really helpful because then you say, okay, yeah, so today I should really actually just focus on this, which means I should not be paying attention to my emails or any of that shit until like 2 p.m. Until this is done. Just wait till this is done. And then it also helps you set up for the future. So that's one of my favorite ways to do it. And the other one is just to actually, I in particular, because of my role on the team, tend to have a lot more conversations about like what I should be doing at any given point in time because I'm a little bit more slippery.
Yeah, like an eel.
Like or a kind fish. Of, or a frog. So I can basically fill a lot of different roles.
So sometimes would you say you have to eat yourself?
Sometimes that first frog to eat is to say, I'm going to have a talk.
One of my favorite things to do is to have clearly laid out goals for specific domains. So it's easy to just be like, I should save more money. Like you could
everybody
say that.
Should.
Everybody should do that. Everybody yep. says that. But
before
where and why and how should you invest it? Should you save it? You know, whatever. But if you say, you know, I need to save X dollars by the time I'm 40, then now all of a sudden you have an idea of how many dollars a day you need to be setting aside, whether you should be investing it, you know, all those things. And so when it comes to sort of calibrating what your activities are on a day-to-day basis, knowing where you're actually trying to go really helps with that. Mm-hmm. So the same thing goes with health. You know, a lot of people say, I'm going to exercise more. Well, that's a good thing, but if you don't have an actual destination, then it makes it harder because technically any amount of exercise you do is more right. and now you've done it already. But if you say, like, I want to run a 6-minute mile.
Or you can say, I want to go to the gym 4 times this week.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Get a thing that you can actually measure.
Yeah. Goals should always be measurable. But I think the problem that a lot of people have is they try not to structure their lives. They kind of, like, we always often talk about the work-life balance thing, and people tend to view their work as work and their life as something else. And we tend to view everything as work. It's just something that you do.
Everything is the same thing.
Everything is the same thing. And if you want to really go places in your life, then I think having an actual plan on where the fuck you're going, you know, helps you go there. So,
Adam, you
make goals.
What was the prompt again?
What systems do you use to help prioritize your work day in life?
I guess, most of my days are just make as much progress as I can towards something that I'm working on. So if we take like B-Scotch ID stuff or something, right? I have a very long-term goal for that. And I know exactly what all those endpoints are. I know what I need to achieve with that thing. What I'm going to get done today, I have no fucking clue, right? Because I don't know how long anything
is. But you do have a target. Like, you do have a long-term goal. Yeah, I've got a target.
But when it comes to prioritizing the day, for me, it's usually clear out all the little stuff.
Eat the frogs.
Mm-hmm.
I eat the little frogs.
You eat the
I think this is different
frogs.
Than what Sam was talking
frogs.
About. Because Sam's is confusingly metaphorical somehow.
It so
is.
You're basically eating sort of like crickets.
Yeah.
And
yeah, yeah.
sort of
just like
small
mealworms.
Mealworms.
You know? Mm-hmm. Ants, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you basically scoop up all the little guys and you eat those first thing. Clear out any meetings. Just do all the other stuff that could occupy mind space. And then just fucking buckle up. And work
buckle up.
Yep. And
buckle your pants.
Build that mental model and just work on stuff. Because for me, it's mostly getting that mental model built of the project that I'm working on and then just attacking that thing and trying to get it done. Taking that in conjunction with the good enough principle.
The good enough
how
principle.
How I do stuff.
Mm-hmm. Man.
Because then I'm always just making as much progress as is possible.
Cool. So there was a great metaphor, speaking of excellent metaphors. Mm-hmm. That I was reading last night, which I think we may have talked about this a long time ago, but it's basically the idea of if you think about your time as like a bucket and about the tasks that you need to do as sort of different sizes of like rocks, mm-hmm. and you're going to fill this bucket. So if you had a whole bunch of sand, meaning like representing all the little things that you need to take care of that don't matter that much, but that they just kind of like always there. And then you've got a bunch of like big rocks, which are the things that really matter to you that are definitely going to take a lot of time, but they're really important. If you put the sand in first, then it creates a new floor, right? Yep. And you actually can't fit all the big rocks in, right? So you have to give up a bunch of those things. If you put the big rocks in first, then you put the sand in afterwards, then it fills
the spot.
It fills the empty spaces. Right. So in other words, it's a metaphor meaning, try to allocate your time toward the things that matter to you the most first. And then, you know,
yeah, which is literally the opposite of what I do.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. Yeah.
So,
and for there, it's because you can't realistically just pour sand on top of a bunch of pebbles. Cause it doesn't work its way through all the cracks unless you shake the fuck out of it.
Well, yeah, right? you gotta shake that bucket.
So somehow you gotta shake your life up. If that's the strategy, I would prefer the strategy where, You just get rid of the sand, you know, because I'm not putting the sand in the bucket.
But here's the
I'm
thing.
Bailing it out.
The sand comes back every day.
It does, yeah. But you also put strategies in place using the can we not principle.
So what you do is you'd be like,
okay. To minimize the amount of sand that comes in so that only the sand that must be taken care of actually.
So you ask the question, do I need to
So your bucket is here on this table, right? And every day some asshole comes and just like plops some sand.
Like you're going to need to put that in
the same place on the table. And then the next day, they come to drop that sand on there and they find that you've cut a hole in the table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's how I handle email, for example, using unsubscribes.
You just delete everything.
I unsubscribe so hard from emails that now out of habit, even if I'm just reading another email, I actually still scroll and look for an unsubscribe link at the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Even if it's from a dear friend.
Yeah, even
if
it's from me. Because I was,
hey Adam, how's it going? You're like, oh, unsubscribe.
It's just
a habit. Unsubscribe.
Just reply in all caps.
Yeah. Somebody calls you.
It's please take me off your list.
Adam, I haven't talked to you in years. Unsubscribe.
Yeah, and if a title of an email looks even vaguely like a solicitation for a service or something, then I delete it immediately. And if I see it again, I'd mark it as spam.
Yep.
My inbox is so fucking clean.
Because you can choose not to do most things, which is embodied in our Can We Not mugs over at shop.bscotch.net. Now on sale for Cyber Monday week.
In a bundle.
No, wait, no, it isn't. They're it is in a bundle.
Aren't the bundles on sale?
Yeah, yes. The bundles are on sale.
But the one by itself is not on sale.
Yeah, well, you know, obviously you would buy a bundle. I mean, the savings are unreal. all right. Next question comes from M-Cade or I'm Cade?
I am Cade.
I am Cade.
It's like I am legend, but he's a Cade, whatever that is.
He's
it's a
Cade.
Type of insect, I think.
I think it's an arcade cabinet, but with the R taken off.
It's just a Cade. Cade cabinet.
So instead
cabinet.
Of like arcade as a question, it's I am
is
Cade.
Is Cade.
Yeah.
I am Cade.
This is the answer to the question.
Arcade? Arcade. I am Cade. I am Cade. I am Cade says.
This is a group situation.
What are your thoughts on pre-order and beta testing rewards? Example, paid for a game in beta. I was promised sweet loot for being a founder. But the week of launch, you could order the game and the same stuff I got for being a founder. What are your thoughts?
So this is actually really weird and complicated because so part of it is to think about it not just from, so if you think about it from a business standpoint, there's some angles that come that are very obvious. And you think about it actually from overall sort of delivery of an experience standpoint, there's other ones that I think are less obvious. So for us, part of the reasons why whenever we talk about the ability, for example, to do like a beta buy-in thing, like you actually just buy the game, but you're buying it and getting access to the beta. Part of it is that as people who have played a lot of games and have been very excited about some games, having the being able to deliver that experience to someone where it's like you get to get in early is super cool, right? Very exciting. But when it comes to actually the business side of things, we've actually only sort of been bitten by it because we did pre-orders with Crashlands, but they were full price because I think they're full price, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So we just put up a pre-order
on Steam only.
On Steam only, and you got it through Humble. And that was a very easy way for us to, I mean, we didn't need to do it. I think we did it because we were like, this seems like a good thing.
People do pre-orders, right? Let's do pre-orders.
And the thing to understand is like, we didn't make, like we made maybe a couple $1,000s off it.
Not even.
Not even?
I think about a thousand.
Maybe $1,000 total. Yeah. And this is when the company had no money. So of course that was a huge spike in revenue.
like a quintupling of our monthly revenue.
but overall, it didn't actually matter much. And what it actually did is put us in this weird bind, exactly what you're talking about, which is we ended up when we went into the launch window, that was where, you know, a lot of people at that point in time were doing say like a 10% discount or 50%
like a launch
discount.
Day sale.
Yeah, just to get people really excited about getting in on the ground floor. And we actually realized that we couldn't quite do that. You know, we didn't feel good about doing that because our like that sort of the founders, the people who got in really early and didn't get anything.
They paid full price.
Paid full price. We would be sort of like kind of slapping them in the face a little bit by giving.
Ooh, had you not pre-ordered, you would have gotten a discount.
Tips it up, yeah. So it's one of those things actually as a dev that's really hard to, because it's just impossible to foresee the situation that you're going to launch in and also kind of what the context of that is. It's basically impossible to not like potentially cause some strife.
Some backlash.
With something that you were trying to actually make an interesting.
But if you think about it from the other side too, if you were a person who wasn't involved with the beta testing or whatever, all these beta testers got some extra sweet loot, right? And then you go, you hadn't even heard of the game,
right?
Like comes out, you see it pop up on Steam. In other words, this looks like exactly the kind of thing
you were
just love.
Innocent bystander.
You're an innocent bystander. Right. So now you go buy the game, you get into it, you're playing, having a fucking great time. Then you're like, ooh, I'm not sure how this thing works. So then you go look in the forums, you know, and you join some community and you're just fucking pumped about this game. And then you see a screenshot of somebody showing off some cool armor.
Their dope ass hoverboard.
Yeah. And you're like, oh, that's awesome. Like, what do I need to do in the game to get that? And they're just like, oh, you can't.
You can't.
Like, it's
that
in the game.
Sucks. Yeah.
Yeah, it's in there because I can play it. You know, my game copy is the same as your game copy. The thing is there. You just don't get to have this.
Right.
Forever now.
Yeah. And now couple that with the fact that except in very, very rare, weird circumstances, the vast, vast majority of all the people playing a game are people who did not beta test it. And correct. Did not pre-order it, which means that you've basically just decided to give this very limited pool of people access to content that you're just not letting the majority of your players have.
Even if they would enjoy it.
Through no fault of their own.
They didn't know.
Maybe they didn't have the cash on hand to pre-order at the time.
And most people wouldn't even have known because people don't pay that much attention to stuff.
Right.
So there will
especially
be people,
games that haven't launched yet.
Right. So my personal position on this is that that using these things is basically just bribery to try to convince somebody to do something that they don't want to do. Because if you're saying...
I don't think it ever does that, though.
But if you're saying, you like, know? Pre-order and you get this pre-order bonus.
Right.
It's this exclusive content that you won't get.
Right.
If because I think importantly, what's the point of pre-ordering?
There is no point.
Right.
There's no reason to
pre-order. Well, no, but that's where I disagree. Because I think part of the excitement of like being wrapped up in sort of, you know, the pre-launch process for a game is actually just being really, really excited and being able to declare, like, I'm really fucking pumped about Fallout 4 or whatever else. I'm going to pre-order it. You know, like sure. It's, I think it's actually a,
and that's fine
from a user experience standpoint.
You shouldn't get rewarded in addition. If the idea is that this is already a reward,
right,
for being excited about the thing as a consumer of it, then you don't need to add this other stuff on top.
I agree. And that's I think where we kind of landed on it, which was we won't be offering like, you know, variable rewards of any sort, actual content rewards of any sort, for any pre-order stuff in the future, just because it starts putting us in this weird, just really weird place. And as far as even just offering pre-orders, it's just sort of that question of, you know, if we're at a point where we think we actually sort of know what our plan is and what our launch plan is going to be, which was part of the problem with Crashlands at that time, then we can more constructively kind of figure out a mechanism to do that. If it's a 10% thing, like, oh, 10% off if you pre-order, we're also going to do a 10% launch day sale, just so you know, everyone going in with open eyes.
Or maybe a 9% launch day sale. So you're going to save that penny.
That's right.
You know,
but alternatively, if... Because like you're saying, the getting into a thing early and being part of the dev process and that kind of stuff is the thing that people get excited about. I'm excited about for other games that mm-hmm. aren't the ones we make, you know. So as a consumer of games, you get excited when something is coming out that you like and you want to get involved. That in itself is already a reward.
Right.
And in fact, a lot of games, especially a couple of years ago, back when early access was actually important and did mm-hmm. good things, you know. A lot of games would, or there was a handful of games that would sell more during early access than at launch.
Right.
And they actually,
Really common.
It was really common. Yeah. And they explicitly told people, hey, this is the price now. We're actually going to have a lower price at launch. This higher price, is basically meant to sort of like actually gatekeep a little bit, right. Like keep, because we don't want
get the people who care and
get the people who really care to be really excited about it. And so they actually use it as a mechanism to kind of keep their population of players a little bit lower even. Right. And so it can be okay if you do a launch day sale, but your beta testers got the game for full price or whatever, right? If everybody knows that that's either that that's going to happen or that's a possibility.
Right.
So that now they're opting into that system so that now it doesn't feel unfair. Like they didn't know what was going to happen. And because the fact is that, you know, we didn't need to still launch at full price when we launched Crashlands because our beta testers or all the people who pre-ordered the game, we let them get into the beta if they wanted to.
That's true, right.
So we actually gave them all early access. Right. And these are all the people who are the most pumped about the game.
I think we also sent them extra keys.
We did for our beta testers.
Yeah.
Who,
not for pre-orders, maybe.
Correct.
Yeah.
But many of those are actually the same. So
they're basically the same 100 people.
Right. And so what those people who were really actually opting into was being a part of...
It's being a part of the biggest
It's being
thing.
A part of that thing.
Right. 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 And I think that is what the value of it is. So when people are always very anti-pre-orders, I think it's... I agree with it in some of these cases when it comes to the fact that oftentimes it's this weird business practice that's happening. But I think if they're handled really, really effectively, then you do actually get that really wonderful feeling of being a part of this thing before it happens and also kind of being on the ground floor. This idea of being a founder, for example, like those founder packs, I mean, there's a ton of games now on Steam that have a founder pack, even when they launch fully, but they have like a, you can basically just pay more for it.
Yeah.
Even. Right. I think... is it Heat Signature or something like that? One of the new ones that came out actually just has a version that just costs like $10 more. It's like a supporter pack, I think. I was looking at this yesterday. Yeah. You just pay more.
You can just pay more. Same game.
Which is cool. I'm like, it's, you know, if you're into it, go for it.
I mean, itch.io has their pay what you want slider. Mm-hmm. You can set a floor and you can say like the game costs $5, but people can pay whatever they want for it, you know, which is a thing that some people really go after.
Yeah. So I think if they're oriented around getting people to feel involved in a community that's around the game and in a movement that's around the game, then I think pre-orders are actually awesome.
Yeah. But I think that is where pre-order content fucks everything up.
Yes.
Because it changes the relationship.
Yeah. Well, it becomes transactional instead of social.
Yeah. Well, because now the person isn't becoming involved in the launch of the game. They're buying content for mm-hmm. the game, which is just a different kind of thing. And so now that relationship is different. And I think only for the worse.
Right. All right. So the next question comes from Peebnuts123.
Amazing.
You guys have grown. So I think it's, I mean, I'm probably 5 more pounds.
I've actually shrunk.
Adam shrunk. Mm-hmm. Sam grew a little bit.
Yeah.
So probably, I think on average, we're maybe 1 or 2 pounds up. Yeah. You guys have grown, so I think it's probably a good time to ask about team sizes. What team sizes do you think are optimal? What are the biggest challenges in scaling? How many people is too many? So I think two is probably too many. the optimal team size is one, because you will never get a more efficient allocation of time.
Yep. No communication to worry about.
You know, no meetings, no planning. Your resource costs are very low.
The entire organization is just self-aware of every moving part.
Yeah. Yep. There's nothing really incredible. If you're a team size of one, nothing happens on the team that the entire team is unaware of, you know?
Mm-hmm. You didn't have to tell anybody about it.
Then you have to, no meetings, no emails, no, no syncing up. Your synergy is through the roof.
A team of two is almost as good, because there's actually just one line of communication.
Yeah.
And if you're...
Yeah, I think a team of two is actually infinitely worse.
I mean, it's infinitely worse, but somehow also...
the difference
also,
between two and three is really big, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because a team of one is the perfect team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a team of two, there's one line of communication you got to manage.
Yeah.
And
if you're working... Which is a lot, though.
It's a lot, but if you're working in the same space, you can kind of like... You're kind of picking up on
You kind of know. Yeah.
So it's not quite into the management territory. And then you get into the three...
But two, it is the case of that as soon as you have two people, now systems have to be in place.
Yep. You need systems.
I need to know what you're doing.
Right. When you have three people, it's still the same systems. Now they just have to be more efficient. And then that just kind of goes.
Because when you go from two to three, you actually go from one line of communication to three lines of communication.
Or two per person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because I need to know what Seth's doing. Seth needs to know what Adam's doing. And I need to know what Adam's doing, blah, blah. So
each person needs to know what two other people is up to.
Correct. And then as you go up from there, the number of communication lines explodes.
Yeah.
So even at
combinatorial explosion,
even at our small size, we start handling like a dozen, just some stupid number for how many people we have.
I think when you have 10 people on your team, there's 4 billion lines of communication.
Approximately. Yeah. Something like that.
At least.
Yeah. So I think if it really depends on what you're trying to do. I think if you're learning and you're early on in your dev stuff, I think having just you is super kick ass, because you really in depth learn each aspect of the thing, or at least, you know,
and nothing slows you down.
Nothing but you.
Except for your own, except for your own personal problems.
Which usually there are a lot
of. There are many.
so you got to work on those. And then once you work those out, then you get another person. Because the beauty of having more people is that if all your systems are functioning well and your people are functioning well, then you can do a lot of things simultaneously, which you just can't do. We've talked about multitasking. It's dumb. It doesn't work. So once you have, you know, a couple people at your disposal, then Adam can be building web tech. Seth programs the game, and I go talk to people about it. And
now three things are happening
at the same
time.
It's crazy.
And now we have to have meetings.
Then we have to have a meeting. Yeah, we have to have a meeting.
What happened?
Like, how was that talking to people? And you're like, good. And I was programming the game. I'm like, pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And now we've synced up.
Yep.
So
your syncing costs have to be kept as low as possible.
Because basically your administrative overhead scales up with the sort of... the explosive scale of those communication lines. So you gotta figure out how to lock that down so you're not just trapped in meeting hell all the time.
Which is why anytime I talk to somebody who's like, oh, we're starting up a studio, you know, I have me and 8 friends or something. I'm like, no.
Fire everybody.
Cool, fire everybody. keep it as small as possible at the outset.
Have a really good reason for each person that gets added. Like, like as in...
Nobody else can do it.
Yeah, as in nobody else can do it, or if that person isn't there, then there's no way you can actually get the work done you need to get done.
Yeah.
Right. So like that's where we were when we taking our studio wrangler as an example. So Seth used to have to handle all of our legal and accounting stuff.
Yeah.
So that meant every week you'd easily spend what?
Which wasn't a big deal before Crashlands.
Mm-hmm.
Because we didn't
very
have any
minimal
money and no legal.
We had
stuff
no
to
money
pretend.
And nobody was trying to do business with us.
Yeah.
So
this is referred to as breaking the hound barrier, where suddenly you've been successful enough that you have to invest in the things that help you keep that success.
Because you're being hounded?
No, as in like...
Is this like a guard thing again?
Oh. Yeah. It's like getting a guard dog for the house, you know?
The hound barrier.
Breaking the hound barrier.
Oh, because you have enough stuff that you need
that you have to invest in securing it.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is what that is. Once Crashlands hit, then we're like, oh shit.
Yeah, because it's
spend
true.
20 hours a week doing all this
stuff. Back before Crashlands, like money just came in and we just paid ourselves, and that was the end of the story.
Well, literally nothing happened.
Almost no money came in, but
like almost all that little
like
money that did come in just went right back out to us as the employees of the company, right?
Yeah,
and we had very little like our overhead in terms of software, in terms of legal stuff, and like everything was very low because we couldn't.
We couldn't afford any of it.
We couldn't afford anything that
so
would cost
us. So we just
us.
Didn't
also,
have it.
Well, also, the cost of adding any one additional service, because there's only three of us, was also super low.
Yeah.
So if we were like, oh, maybe I'll try this Dropbox plan thing. It's like, okay, just do it because it's $50. Who cares?
Yep.
But now if you're like, okay, we're going to try
Udemy. Now it costs us $1,500 a year for Dropbox.
Yeah. So it's like, that's kind of a decision now that has to be made as opposed to just
now
being
you got to
like,
have
whatever.
A meeting about it.
Yep.
Damn it.
Sucks. So.
Yeah. So then once... As things grow, then things have to keep growing to sort of maintain it. And so the goal, you got to keep all that in check really, really hard.
And I will say, if you don't have any interest in running a studio, do not grow beyond like three people.
Yeah.
Or maybe even
two. And also don't have any success.
Also don't have any success. Yeah.
That is true. Because whether we added people or not, we would be buried by business negotiations and everything else.
Yeah. Yeah. Before we got our full team on, the truth is like we were just... handling being alive.
We were drowning.
Instead of it. Yeah.
Yep.
It sucked.
Yeah.
So in that case, the optimal team size is however many you need.
Yeah.
To get everything.
Ideally one less than that.
Yeah. I think everybody needs to still be scrappy and kind of fighting for it.
People can do a little more than they think they can.
Yeah. Because if you're ever unsure if like someone is like really going at something because like there's so many people that you can't really tell, you know, like
what do you do here?
Well, yeah, exactly. Right. Then you got too many people. Yeah. At that point.
Yeah. And actually, so we had a friend staying from Germany for the past few days, old college friend, and over to GB.
Mm-hmm.
And she was fascinated about just how our studio works and everything. And she's an MBA, and she was asking all kinds of questions about just like how business is run here in the United States and everything. And she was most interested in the concept of at-will employment.
Mm-hmm.
Because in Germany, if somebody is to leave a company, there's a 3 months notice requirement, regardless of the circumstance.
Yeah. So if a manager is firing someone or if that person's quitting, you have to give 3 months notice.
And you're still there for 3 months, just knowing. So apparently it's very hard to exit a company, no matter what the circumstances are. If the company's out of money, somehow they're still legally required to keep that person around. Mm. Or every person around for 3 months and give them adequate notice. I don't understand the logistics of this.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's a very conservative approach.
So it still might only apply to large companies. I have no idea.
It might, but I guess then that is the case. Then you have to be even more wary of like, if you say, oh, we're going to have, 10 people on our team and you start up a studio and all of a sudden you discover that you can't handle that. And you're also now legally obligated to keep everybody around.
Yeah. Well, especially when you're really small, everybody on the team is super essential to the functioning of that team.
Yep.
And so if you also can't replace somebody because of the legal setup of wherever you're doing things, and because the costs are too high, then that makes now the cost of hiring
really scary.
And the risks of hiring really, really out of control. Mm-hmm. And that was something that we worry about a lot with too, even though we don't have nearly as big of a problem as that, as an at-will system.
Yeah, we're in the U.S. where the government is like, oh, your business? Okay, laws don't apply.
Yeah. No problem. Well, but when you get big enough, they start applying again. Yeah. But it makes sense, because the fact is the small companies like ours wouldn't be able to survive those laws.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You'd be very agile to stay alive. Yeah.
All companies would, all the companies that existed once that law went into place, if it existed, would be the only companies that ever got to exist from now on.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it does say something about, why it is that Silicon Valley, that the sort of like heart of the startup scene of the world is in the US because of the extremely loose requirements for a small company to get started and get off the ground, which there basically are none. Mm-hmm. You need to be a legal entity, which would cost you like $100.
Then you're good to go.
And now you're good to go.
Yep.
So anyways, moral of the story when it comes to team sizes,
small as possible.
Keep it.
And then minus one.
Yeah, small as possible, minus one.
Unless you're solo, in which case, keep the one. Keep the one. Well, there's a sort of a max.
Maybe, I don't know. Yeah.
There's a min.
There's a min function here. No, a max function. You want to keep it. There's a floor. All right. All right, so that's all the time we have for this week. So we'd like to thank our studio wrangler, Monique, and our producer, Fat Barb, for putting this episode together, and the Beescotch dev team for having our backs while we record this podcast. Special thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord and forums running. And if you'd like to get more involved in the Beescotch community, you can head over to our Discord server, which is at discord.gg/Beescotch. Come say hey. Also, if you'd like to adorn your body with Butterscotch merch, you can check out our shop, which is at shop.bscotch.net. And as I mentioned earlier, we are having a Cyberman Week sale. So get those bundles at, I think they're 10% off.
Thank you, man.
Which, considering they are, I think, $35,000 per bundle normally.
Huge savings.
So the savings are just, I mean, yeah. Astronomical. Mm-hmm. Also, if you'd like to adorn us with your swag, we have a mailbox. So you can send us something over at mailbox.bscotch.net. We'll appreciate it. We open everything. And we also get alerts so that we know when something arrives. That doesn't mean that we will be able to get it immediately. So don't send us puppies.
No living beings.
No living creatures of any kind. We cannot guarantee how long they will be there.
No food that spoils.
No spoiling food. No meat.
Time frame.
Just think about it. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Although jerky would probably work.
Jerky?
I don't think jerky ever spoils.
Yeah, it never spoils.
Yeah. Because it's just salt and
it's just delicious.
Yep. Yeah. All right. So that's all the time we have. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye. Bye.